Among the potential perks of accident of birth, an Australian passport ranks highly. It allows those who possess one, such as this correspondent, to come and go more or less as they, well, we, please. On Passport Index's Global Passport Power Ranking, Australia's is equal 7th, permitting a visa-free saunter into 85 countries and receiving a visa on arrival, few if any questions asked, in another 44. The Australian passport also has considerable ancillary soft power benefits. A document adorned with a kangaroo and an emu has a remarkable power to lower temperature and tension at potentially fraught checkpoints. The more so if your particular Australian passport betrays your place of birth as Wagga Wagga, New South Wales. Whatever this may cause people to think of you, it isn't as a threat. So, while not wishing to appear ungrateful, the Australian passport in my desk drawer here in London is nevertheless, right now, significantly less than usually useful. Because one of the few places it does not enable me to go is Australia.
There is no too-weak answer to what we're confronting. There is no short-term quick fix to how this is dealt with in Australia. The idea that you can just turn everything off for 2 weeks and then just turn it all back on again and it all goes away, that is not the evidence, and it's not our way through this. And it's not what you see in the measures that we've already announced and the measures that we will continue to announce.
Australia took a notably hard line from the earliest stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. By the numbers, Australia's hauling up of the drawbridges has worked. Among a population of 25 million or so, fewer than 30,000 confirmed cases and 911 deaths. Normal life has now largely resumed, give or take occasional snap lockdowns.
The whole state will enter stage 4 restrictions until the end of Wednesday.
But when Australia locked out the world, it locked out a large number of Australians who were elsewhere in it. Before COVID-19 struck, it was estimated that maybe 1 million Australians lived overseas. Some returned during the pandemic, especially early on, but many did not or could not, and now cannot, at least not easily. Arrivals are rigorously and/or whimsically capped, and hotel quarantine is enforced, which also has to be paid for by anyone lucky enough to find a flight and wealthy enough to afford one. Among the marooned are nearly 40,000 citizens who actually live in Australia and have not been able to return to their jobs, homes and families, in some cases for more than a year. Last month, some of these stranded Australians filed legal action against Australia's federal government with the United Nations Human Rights Committee in Geneva.
The two men, Alex and Jason, say their ability to return home is an absolute right which shouldn't be blocked by travel caps.
It would have seemed, would still seem, the easiest of wins for Prime Minister Scott Morrison to declare that, by hook or by crook, Australia would get its people home if it had to send the VIP fleet of the Royal Australian Air Force to collect them and then look after them in some temporary desert redoubt upon their return. It's not like we don't have the space or the resources. And yet Morrison hasn't and doesn't. He seems to have calculated that a plurality of Australian opinion is not altogether unhappy with the present situation. He might well be right. Until quite recently in Australia's history, it has been accustomed to thinking of itself as a remote and self-contained place, living acquiescently beneath what the historian Geoffrey Blainey called the tyranny of distance. Within the last week, Australia erected further barricades. Alarmed by the acceleration of COVID-19 in India, Australia not merely banned all flights from India until at least May 15th, but declared that any Australian who snuck back from India regardless would face 5 years in jail and or a fine of $66,000, a mandate which raised a bleak smile from those of us whose ancestors had to commit a crime to get sent to Australia in the first place.
Government has abandoned us. Instead of, you know, pulling us out, they have abandoned us and told us, you know, you are on your own.
A PR challenge looms. Among the thousands of Australians in India are members of the national cricket team who were competing in the now suspended Indian Premier League. Australia's government faces a choice between abandoning the country's venerated cricketers to the virus or making it painfully obvious that some citizens are more equal than others. As we go to air, the idea seems to be to extract the players via the Maldives or Sri Lanka. Meanwhile, one non-cricketing 73-year-old Australian citizen, a Gary Newman of Melbourne, who has been stuck in India since March 2020, has launched proceedings in a federal court in Sydney in a bid to be allowed home. Behind such present ballyhoos, however, lurks a longer-term question, which both Australia's government and many of Australia's people seem reluctant to answer. When does this end? If we assume, as I'm going to, as I've grown quietly fond of several members of my family and would like to see them again one day, that Australia is not embarking upon eternal isolation, at some point a decision to re-engage is going to have to be made, and with it, some risk accepted.
They're designed, based on the medical advice, to keep Australians safe. We're doing everything we can to support India at this very difficult time. We've also got to protect Australians.
Polls show hefty majorities in favour of keeping the borders closed, even to their fellow citizens. It would certainly be preferable to believe that this is exclusively on public health grounds. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.